Hey, it's Jacob Goldstein from Business History. In our new series, American Genius, we tell the stories of three great writers who changed the way business works in America. Our first episode is about Benjamin Franklin, who, among many other things, was a best-selling business writer. Take a listen.
He's writing this much later in his life, consciously creating this image of himself. And I do want to emphasize how unusual this model is at the time, this self-made man myth, because you don't want to be self-made. It's low class to be self-made. You know, this idea that we have today is the opposite, right? And it comes from Franklin. Today, there is the derisive term nepo baby.
Well, exactly right. And these days, if you are a billionaire, you had better have a Benjamin Franklin story about starting in a garage, coming up with the idea from nothing.
And here is Benjamin Franklin inventing it right before our eyes.
This has been brought to you by Odoo. To listen to more of our American Genius series, listen to Business History. New episodes release every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Big transfer news today.
Who's moving?
Me. To the couch. With Domino's best deal ever since they just added stuffed crust.
Any pizza, any toppings, now with stuffed crust for $9.99.
It's a long-term contract with no release clause.
Only $9.99? Yeah, that sounds like the move. I'm heading straight to
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6/15 through 7/26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings, 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Samuel Bateman thought two outsiders with a camera at his table were going to make him famous. He had absolutely no idea who Christine Marie was or her past, and that she had fallen for a false prophet once herself. He had no idea he'd be the subject of a Netflix documentary series about his coercive control and far worse actions. He had no idea Christine Marie would lead to a 50-year prison sentence. Today, Christine Marie joins us to have a conversation about her experiences living with and filming what became, trust me, the false prophet. She joins myself, a retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, Robin Drake, to discuss. Christine, let's start with this. You and Tolga came to Shore Creek for something else entirely. You didn't necessarily show up there expecting to meet Samuel Bateman, not to chase a man like that. Let's back up before Sam even enters the picture. What's your original project? What's your original inspiration to go to Short Creek before Sam even enters your life? What's your thoughts on and what the next 5 to 10 years are going to look like for you before Sam?
Interesting question, because we were living in Las Vegas. I was finishing my PhD, so I was at the point where I was working on my dissertation research and I could live wherever I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to move out of Las Vegas and help the people from Short Creek, believing that all of them were victims of some kind and some kind of religious trauma. And because I had experience with that and developed an expertise in that, I thought, you know, let me go and help the people who've left the FLDS understand what happened to them. And then things unfolded from there.
Did you go into that understanding how difficult it might be to reach someone who has gone through that? I know, obviously, you've had your own experiences, and you are so uniquely qualified for everything that you did and everything that you went through. But having that experience for oneself and making those own realizations are very different than helping others necessarily get to that point. What kind of wall did you face, or what kind of hill did you climb? Was it as steep as you expected?
Oh my goodness. It was more complicated than I imagined, because the FLDS at this time were very reclusive. Mm-hmm. They would, you know, they were encouraged not to talk, even talk to outsiders. So I didn't expect that I would ever really have any FLDS friends. I was focusing on the ex-FLDS. Mm-hmm. But even then, they have this in-group, out-group bias that's been ingrained in them from birth. You know, either you're a member or you're a non-member, you're from a high-status family or a low-status family. I mean, this us versus them thinking was very strong. So even though I thought I will help, I will do my best to try to help the ex-FLDS, I was still an outsider to them. So that was tough, and it took a lot for me to have any breakthrough at all.
What is it like there in Short Creek? I mean, you came in as a complete outsider. Is it, I mean, as an outsider coming into a very close-knit community, you had to have stood out like a sore thumb, I would think. I mean, tell me about that, and how long were you trying to become part of the fabric of this community that is in a bit of chaos at the moment, prior to meeting Sam?
Well, I started trying to build trust with the community actually the year before I moved there in 2015. And what I did was I decided that since the FLDS don't have Christmas, and since Warren Jeffs had apparently banned all the toys, now that there was a group of ex-FLDS, I needed to teach him about Christmas.
Meister Burger.
oh my goodness. It was like I was going to be the antidote to the Grinch who stole Christmas.
Yes.
And I had this alter ego, you know, as Mrs. Gingerbread, which you might have seen a little clip of me as a ventriloquist. Okay. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm gonna do my puppets and bring Christmas to these children that don't even know about Christmas. So that my first foray into gaining trust in the community happened the year before I moved there. And we brought in semi-truckloads of toys, and we had this big dinner called the First Christmas, where we explained what the Christmas tree is for and what candy canes represent and all this stuff. So that was number one. So that was just trying to earn the trust of the ex-FLDS. And that was a lot of fun. Then my husband and I noticed some evictions going on and started realizing that something didn't feel right, the way they were being handled. And we took photos and we shared them on Facebook, like, what in the heck is going on here? And then that created sort of a World War III among the FLDS, ex-FLDS. Mm-hmm. And because they just thought, as outsiders, we can't possibly know like the ins and outs of why people were being evicted that way. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know that we had been educated on it and we knew the other side. So we met some people, two FLDS ladies at a gas station nearby. And I just went up to them and said, you know, I'm so sorry for what you're going through. And they were like, what are we going through? We're going through a lot, but which thing are you talking about? And I told them about the pictures on Facebook. Mm-hmm. and the insane response. I mean, the outside world was in agreement with us, but the people from the town weren't happy that we were, you know, sharing these photos. And we had permission of everybody in the photos to share them. So go ahead.
You were trying to advocate for them.
I was.
You know, so what were they upset about? When they're pushing back, what is the pushback about?
Well, the ex-FLDS were getting the properties that were being evicted. So the FLDS were being evicted. The ex-FLDS were getting those properties. So for or us to be saying, hey, these evictions, this seems wrong. And there's a lot more to it. It just created trouble among the people who were going to benefit by getting those properties.
Okay.
So, but there was also a large sector of town that respected us for what we were doing because they agreed. So, you know, we were kind of in the middle, but we didn't know any FLDS. So we were advocating for the FLDS without even knowing any of them, just saying, this doesn't seem right. So when we met these two ladies at the gas station, they were amazed. And that was like, why are these outsiders defending us? You know, and that was the beginning of us gaining trust in the FLDS long before we met Sam Bateman. I mean, I think we met Sam maybe 9 months after we moved there.
So, Christina, what I'm really curious about is you are doing such an incredible job with behaviors of trust, as I define them, as open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability, and doing the number one thing we did in the spy recruiting world is identifying a critical life challenge that someone has and being a resource for them solving it. And so that was so intuitive to you, and I think it's one of the greatest reasons why you're so successful with the people's lives that you touch. But I'm also curious, the title of the show is Trust Me, Your Daughter's all about Trust Me, her podcast. Define trust. What does trust mean to you? How do you define it?
I think it is when you know you can count on someone to be acting in integrity and have your best interest at heart. It's the, I don't even know how much truth is important in trust, because when I think about my experience, the truth could be evaluated different ways. Yeah. I was being deceptive by acting as if I was okay with the things that Sam was doing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the bigger issue was that the real truth, they didn't know. And right. If I wanted them to get to the truth, I had to get Sam out of the picture, no matter what it took.
And one of the things I like defining trust as is, like you said, it not necessarily have to be truth, especially in situations where you're saving lives, but it's really predictable behavior. And you were so consistent, and you started way before the meeting. Was this part of your plan or just who you were about being that person that could be this life-saving person without even inflicting yourself? You were invited in, and so those are the greatest relationships that people see from that opposite side is someone that they can invite in to be that resource when they need it, unobtrusively, and you were so consistent with your delivery. Was that part of it, or planned, not planned, or just rolled with it?
It wasn't planned. It was just an empathetic instinct. These people need help, and I had an advantage because I was not ex-FLDS. See, the town was primarily full of innies and outies. So like people who were still in the FLDS and people who were out. And then there was me and just a small few others. So here I was, a neutral person. So they could talk to me more easily than they could talk to a former member. I mean, the former members were called apostates. So they... talking to them was a no-no. So I knew I had this special opportunity, and I began offering services. Once they were evicted, they needed to find a place to live. How are they going to do that if they don't go on the internet? So I sat there for hours being the internet fingers for so many people. I mean, days, months, trying to help people find a place to live, trying to help people understand what a mortgage is. Some people didn't even know what that word was. Some people didn't have credit. I mean, I helped many people get their very first email, learn how to do the at sign. So I was there being of service just because they needed it. And I know it wasn't a plan at all.
Well,
Bateman obviously becomes part of the picture here with the folks. I mean, the folks that he I don't know if the word is recruited or bamboozled or manipulated. There's so many words we could use for what he did. But the people that were coming into his fold were believing that he was speaking for Warren Jeffs, that he was part of that ecosystem. He's the next chapter, if you will, basically. The folks that were believing him, that were beginning to follow him and trust him, were those ex-FLDS at that point in time, or were they still FLDS and they just thought, oh, this is just the next natural evolution of our faith?
That's a great question. They were still FLDS. They still believed in Warren Jeffs. And Sam became an imposter, saying that he was like the new voice of Warren Jeffs and that Warren Jeffs had died and was speaking through him. So he took upon himself the mantle of being a prophet. That's why they believed in him. Mm-hmm. But only a few of the FLDS, only a small few, ended up falling for his scam. Mm-hmm. Most FLDS were like, no way. We're not having anything to do with you. We're not even letting you near our daughters, you know. And so he was not FLDS. He was an offshoot doing his own thing.
Were there any others trying to pull Sam's scheme? Or was it just, I mean, it seems if you're a very manipulative, evil human being, this is ripe hunting ground for doing this sort of thing. Are there other Batemans or was there other Batemans running around, or was Bateman just kind of the lone wolf that was having access to all the sheep?
Oh, there were others. All right. When Warren Jeffs stopped communicating frequently, I mean, he hadn't communicated to the community in a number of years. So it was a ripe opportunity for wolves in sheep's clothing to come in and seize upon that. He was not the only one. I don't want to mention the names of the other ones, but we still have a worry that other ones will be coming forward as well.
Yeah, what was it about Sam? I mean, this guy had failed so completely in so many aspects of life. What was it that made him just the right person at the right time? Or was it not necessarily him, but those that were vulnerable to someone like him that made him more successful than these other people?
I think it was his narcissism. He had such nerve to claim that he was communicating directly with God. And then he would stay in character, and he would even do these actions with his body. Like he was like looking up, seeing angels, and he'd be like, he would go like this, and then he would act as if he just had an impression from God. And, you know, people weren't used to being bamboozled. They weren't used to being snowed like this. They didn't expect that somebody would have the nerve to be lying about something so important. I think it was their naivete held up against his predatorial instincts that gave him the advantage.
And the second part of that, and I'm sorry, Tony, I'll let you go after this. How did you do it? How were you? We talk about this all the time in our show and in my work in the Bureau. People have leakage. When there's an incongruence between what you feel and what's come out of your mouth, there's leakage because we have this abhorrent repulsion to what these people are doing, even though we know what to say, we know how we should be acting. But what made you so amazingly successful in this world with him and save people's lives was the fact that you were able to be congruent. You didn't have leakage. What was it that kept you from leaking your true feelings when Sam is spewing this complete nonsense? And have him, who is hyper, again, I'm curious, do you think he was hypersensitive and really good at reading people, or so bad that you're able to get away with it with him? Or were you just that awesome, which I think you were?
Oh, he was just so bad at it, clearly. I mean, he told Hogan and I he trusted us with his life. He trusted us with the media more than he trusted himself. That was in the doc.
Yeah.
So there was a little leakage. If you watch it again, you'll see that when I was in the car and Sam, you know, confessed the things that he made his girls do, and I asked how they felt. I said, are you okay? And he was saying, how did you feel? And they were saying things. And I said, trauma. And I was like, oh, I shouldn't have said that. you know, because of course those girls would be traumatized, but I could have blown it right there.
You redirected yourself out of my- really, but you redirected yeah. yourself so well. I mean, you saw it in real time. And when, so I think at this point, he had a positive confirmation bias with you because you're feeding that narcissism really well. And so at some point, and when was that point, do you think, where he actually shifted to a positive confirmation bias to you that allowed you to actually have moments like that where he would dismiss the teeny little blip you gave and just look at the redirect you were doing?
I think that Tolga was my secret weapon. Because Tolga is, he's very charismatic and he's hilarious. He's hilarious, by the way. And he offers so much if you're a narcissist looking for fame. Then Tolga, I mean, has this incredible backstory of his own where, you know, he was a music producer and
yeah.
he won Song of the Year, beating Janet Jackson. You know, I mean, he knows all these celebrities and such. And Sam was drunk on power and hungry for fame. So I think that all of Toga's connections made Sam see more of an advantage to trusting in us because he thought he could use us. Also, I thought one more thing. By this time, we had a certain status among the FLDS. And so we had a certain like status among some of the FLDS. And I think he wanted us to kind of vouch him in because they just thought he was a monster. And if he recruited us into his group or made us friendly to his group, then maybe we would speak well of him to the FLDS so he could find more women.
Yeah. And also get his music video before the Queen.
Excellent point.
Who needs TRL when you got the Queen? You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Exactly.
You guys said such a straight face when you said that stuff. I was like, I can't believe it. You guys pulled that so well. That was nuts.
Yeah. Till we went out the door.
I want to talk about.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead, Tony.
I want to talk about the local police. In Short Creek. I want to talk about them a lot because the visceral reaction I had watching the local officer talk about, you know, oh, his like soft heart or whatever BS he was, you know, spewing to explain his inaction for very obvious problems, you know, makes you want to scream and throw something at your television repeatedly. I want to get your take on this, obviously retrospectively as we're looking at this. Why did this officer not look into this deeper? I know the excuses he gave you, it was presented in the documentary. To me, none of them check out. When you talk to attorneys, they don't check out. It's inaction for a reason. It's either he's lazy, incompetent, or protecting a system and a community in a way that only the local police could, in a system that seems to be shielded from the outside world or accountability in certain ways, shapes, and forms. What's your take? Why?
Okay, so
why?
So I have a number of things to say. So interrupt me so I don't talk too long.
Yeah, go.
So,
go.
No, take them all.
First of all, the local police are not FLDS. The entire police department was replaced under a court order. So there was a big raid in 1953 where the state of Arizona came here and arrested all the polygamists.
Yep.
And that
yep.
that has had intergenerational trauma. I mean, they still talk about that raid. So they want to be sensitive to any kind of raid. Plus, with all the bad press with Warren Jeffs and everything else, the town wants a new image for the community.
And Predator Paradise?
That's what they don't want. All right. Yeah. So,
that's what they're calming. That's what they're crafting.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one aspect. And another aspect is that he had said to me, he's sorry that it took so long, but they have been investigating another case. Okay. But the other thing is that he, I know what you're thinking. What could be bigger than this?
Well, it's not one at a time here either.
Right, right. But another thing was that he took my I had a USB stick with that audio on it, and I handed it to him, and he sent it to the FBI forensic crime lab to make sure there was no malware on it. And so that apparently created a delay for them to even be able to listen to it. Then the final thing is that he was doing what the chief said. These weren't his decisions.
Okay.
He said, so he's taking a lot of heat covering for his chief, I think.
Sure.
So he said that after listening to the tape, the chief did not think that there was enough evidence and so on. Now, I was very frustrated by that because I said, how can you say that there's in this? Because there's more than you saw on the documentary about what was on that tape. And then I had to literally read the Arizona law on him and how that matched. And he was like, you're right. But in spite of all that, they wanted a victim. And I guess, to be fair, many police departments would have wanted a victim as well. So I think that this lack of a victim willing to come forward, yeah, there were victims on the tape admitting there were victims, but were they willing to speak against the perpetrator?
So on that victim one, and Christine, I totally get when you see both sides of it, understand what's going on behind the scenes, bureaucracy, you know, manpower issues. I'm not getting this, send it away to the FBI lab for malware stuff.
That just seems like bullshit.
Right. But I don't get that one. But yeah. At the same time, though, so when someone brings me something and we need a victim, instead of saying, well, I got to wait for a victim, this is where when you have children's lives at stake, you go find a victim. You know, this is where they should have gotten proactive with you to say, all right, here's what we need. Because this is what typically happens when you have a violation of this magnitude. This is where you partner with people, say, here's what we need to have in order to move forward with the prosecutor instead of being passive. And that's where I think everyone got frustrated and you're trying to figure out why were they so passive on something that you have. Right here, it's in their own words on that what's going on, and all you have, and the challenges, and everyone who works this violation knows, it's how do you find someone you can help be courageous enough and let go of the shame enough to say I'm a victim, because they're there.
I know. I mean, it was so frustrating here. I mean, I was interacting with these girls and even the women. I mean, Sam called them his girls, and even the women were very girl-like, very naive, unschooled in the ways of the world.
Yeah.
They don't use the word. They don't say the words. They don't have language for these things. So how do you get somebody to come forward? And I mean, separating them, DCS would come, you know, Child and Family Services came a couple times. Interviewed the girls all lied. The trick is, how do you get that victim when they have the psychological chains of cult mind control?
Yeah.
Do you always need, I mean, when it's there on tape and when they know it's going on, do you always need, especially these are children, you don't necessarily need the child to go, yes, this is actually, you can look at it and make the judgment call. Most people in cases like this, where there is some sort of SA abuse going on, a lot of times they're not going to name their abuser. They're not going to say this is happening, but the law still steps in. I don't understand why this chief of police is not enabling their officers to go forward and do what they need to do. I get there's bureaucracy and things involved. The more disturbing part to me is all the excuses that were being fed to you and to these people. Is this chief still in power? Is it still the same chief that's there?
Yes.
Has yes. there been any sort of in-depth investigation into this guy or this department?
I don't think so, but I do know that a number of people in town are upset with me because it made the police department look bad. But it's
they
not
are bad.
It's not anything I said. I just spoke the truth.
They did. It's so funny. It's so funny. So, you know, they are the ones that made the actions or not actions. You didn't do anything.
You That's shone a light on it. They don't like you shone a light. Yeah.
I was so frustrated that even in the footage that we entrusted to the production company, they said they had to take out a number of scenes of my frustration because the viewers would want to, they would be so frustrated they would want to hit their televisions.
Yeah. I was like so, I was saying.
Exactly. I was so frustrated, you know, and yet there was another complicating factor, which was I didn't enjoy this. I was having flashbacks when I was doing this, and I was having to live this double life that was that I hated. And I, you could see on the documentary, I also was mortified that that when they found out that they were going to suffer so much because they trusted me so much, and I was the one that put their prophet in prison. So that was this big emotional cost to me, even though it was the right thing to do. It was rough.
Let me ask you this. You live there. This is, I mean, you have a finger on the pulse of everyday life, of what gets investigated, what doesn't. You can see it, you know, as a civilian there. Do complaints, do reports, you obviously had your own experience of things not being investigated. Is this a pattern, in your opinion, of other people? Are other people reporting problems like this? I would imagine there's other things that go on in this town that the police need to get the attention of. Are there other people with the same sort of story, maybe not to the same extreme extent, but to some extent, where they go to the local police about problems like this, with people like this, and are they heard? Are things investigated? Or does it take the FBI to step in to actually get something done here when it comes to the abuse of women and children?
I don't have any evidence that of who is reporting and what is being investigated or isn't. I know I've reported some other things as well. And, you know, not like this, but still, they listen. They make you feel heard. But I haven't seen any action, you know, so I don't know. I wanted the FBI right away because I was hearing things while I was interacting with these people that would have been evidentiary gold. And I didn't have any devices to record it. I didn't, you know, I mean, I had my phone, but I couldn't in front of them get out the phone and put on my recorder.
Right.
And plus they could ask to see my phone, which Sam did. So I asked the local police, can I get some recording devices? Can I get some guidance on what to do? And they said that that kind of thing has to go through the FBI. So I was like, get me the FBI. When can I meet the FBI? I want to be official. I want to get these devices. And so when the FBI finally was called in, they would have come in sooner. I mean, in the, this is so frustrating. In the, we were giving so much evidence, video evidence to the local police department. So I assumed that they were watching it all, cataloging it, that there was a bona fide investigation going on. And maybe they did, but there was so much evidence about interstate crime that if they would have just watched the footage, granted, we had a lot of hours of footage, but if they would have just watched it, they could have called the FBI in sooner.
This smells to me, in my opinion, like there's a reason they're not doing that, that they're not wanting the FBI involved, that they're not wanting to be looked into a little bit deeper. That's my opinion. I'm not saying they're doing anything criminal or wrong, but I'm saying it might need a little investigating.
Well, and part of it to me looks like also, let's call the FBI in so we can blame them and not ourselves because we have inept, incompetent.
Immoral, assholes, idiots, pieces
of
shit.
if they're on the take in any way, and not implying anything, but they need plausible deniability for, hey, it was the FBI that did it, not us. We're your friends. We're the good guys. Christian,
I want to ask you this about the FBI getting involved, because I know you went to the police and said, let's get the FBI involved. And they dragged their feet and eventually the FBI got involved. Not the FBI dragging their feet. The FBI flat out said, why weren't we notified sooner? Like, of course. So, maybe you didn't know this at the time. I don't know. I guess, why didn't you contact the FBI directly instead of waiting for the local police? I mean, I get the thought process as well. I'm going to go through the right, you know, channels here. Was that the assumption, or what was going on?
I did contact the FBI directly. Okay. When there was no communication about having listened to the tape, which I thought like they would get back to me in like 3 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A friend of mine gave me the phone number to the FBI agent in St. George. Mm-hmm. And I called him and he explained how it works. And he explained the difference between, I think it's proof, like beyond a reasonable doubt, or what's the other one? Probable cause.
Okay.
So he said, you want, in a case like this, you want beyond your proof to be beyond a reasonable doubt. He explained that to keep, you know, logging everything and working with local police, with the local police department, but that the local police department would be the ones that had to make the referral. So I did call.
Okay.
It was about just a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Two or three weeks after I didn't get a response on the thing. Yeah.
I'm having a hard time with how the sausage is made, you know, behind scenes on this, because having worked in a small resident agency like this, here's what typically happens, both on the local PD side, especially on the FBI side. If something like this comes across your desk, someone calls in with something this substantive, I haven't heard anything from anyone that was wrong with what they said. It's just the typical action that's then taken by everyone is the initiative to take that next step. They kept laying it on you, and every department's pointing the figure over there. Thank God you got a good one that actually laid in hard and said, this is what we need to do. And I'm saddened by the lack of people wanting to take a proactive stance earlier to actually be an active resource for you earlier, because they certainly could have. There's no rule, regulation, or law says we can't do more now.
Oh my goodness. It was so frustrating. I was repeatedly asking, talking to the local police, giving them every little piece of information that I got. Like, I learned that somebody had a baby when she was 18, but the math showed that she would have been 17 when she got pregnant. I gave them that information. That didn't matter. I mean, when I saw that there were over 20 people living in a 2-bedroom house plus like 10 babies, I thought that should amount to something. You know, I reported that. I reported, just everything that I heard. There was one girl who was one of Sam's wives. Well, and she would secretly meet with me in another town because she had a reason to go to that town. And so the tracker on her phone, they all had trackers on their phones. So, but I could meet her at this one place where she was expected to be, and she would tell me things. Now, she was not fully in, so they didn't totally trust her. So she wasn't aware of all the sordid details, but she did tell me whatever she knew. And then I would tell that to the local police. So I was reporting a lot and so frustrated.
Yeah.
So then Sergeant Wilkinson called me and said, Christine, I've finally got some good news for you. He said, we're going to have a meeting. Can you meet in St. George? We're going to meet with people from Arizona and Utah and kind of Horace. And I went down there and I did a PowerPoint presentation on what was going on, what I knew for sure, and what I believed. And they asked if they could record it, and they did. After that, I learned that they had some meeting in Phoenix. And And then it wasn't long after that that the FBI got involved. But what I didn't know was until a couple months ago, I had lunch with Don, the FBI agent that helped me. What I didn't know is that they wanted to get involved, more involved sooner, and that the local police chief was holding them back from meeting with me for a month. Why?
Yeah. Because it would make sense, because the way these, so again, more behind the scenes stuff. So you have the side of this that you're doing because it's righteous. You got to save lives. You got to get people out of harm's way, save girls. That's the righteous side. But then you also have, you know, once you get above the street agent and the cop level that you're dealing with, you have the executive level. This is a, for someone that actually cares about career as well, this is extremely, it's that heavy. I mean, this is like, it's good for everyone involved, saving lives, careers. That's why to have resistance at any level shows that there's something really off somewhere, because these types of cases have tons of energy in healthy places.
Yeah, it was also hard on us because we had to be interacting with Sam Bateman, who the town was laughing at him. Instead of realizing how dire it was, I think they didn't really know the extent of it. We didn't even know the extent of it.
Right.
But they were, we had to pose as if we were cool with everything that Sam was doing. Mm-hmm. So we were also getting pushback from the town. We weren't getting support. We were getting ridiculed and shunned. And we got driven off the road by somebody who gave us the finger. You know, we got doxxed. I mean, we thought, when is this going to end? When are we going to get some help? And it was definitely difficult. And like
where did you get your energy? I mean, that's what keeps coming back to me. Doing undercover work, it's exhausting for a day or two or even a week or two at a time. I mean, the movies like Donnie Brasco talks about, you know, and shows you, and even undercovers, you know, we get they call it a checkup from the head up, you know, every 6 months because of the mental exhaustion and trauma it goes through. Where did you guys get your energy to keep going relentlessly and maintain good mental health?
That is such a good question, because I lost energy at times. I hit a wall at times. I did go into therapy over this, and I think that the therapy helped me to maintain myself when I was with them, to not have the reactions that I wanted to have. I asked my therapist if he knew anybody else that had gone undercover, because I needed to talk to someone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't. I wasn't supposed to talk about it. And I talked about it with my therapist though. And then I will tell you that Toga and I went on a lot of drives that we called de-stress drives, because we didn't know if our house was bugged, to be honest.
Yeah. Right.
Because these people were one of the perpetrators who ended up in prison was the tech guy for the FLDS with cameras and so on. And we didn't know if they bugged our house.
Yeah.
One time I was in my car driving and Sam called me and said, "Christine, I just wanted to tell you how lovely you look in your pink skirt and, you know, your hair up in a ponytail like that." And I thought Sam wasn't there. Sam wasn't at my, he didn't see me get in my car and drive away.
Yeah.
Are there cameras? So we would just have to go on drives where we felt safe to really process everything. And having each other was everything.
I've never seen anything more impressive.
I want to ask one more on as we're talking about the police situation or the lack thereof. Do you feel, because I'm trying to understand why this community is treated like subhumans almost from the police force in terms of recognizing the abuse that's been going on and holding people accountable for it? Is this population looked at by its own police force as unfortunately so many disenfranchised communities do? They don't get the attention they deserve when a crime occurs. We see it in all different communities all across the country all the time. Do they look at this community as there is so much S abuse that is so rampant and so everywhere that there's just really no way to truly police it. There's not enough police to keep up with it. Yeah. And that this community polices itself to a certain extent. Not saying it's right the way it's policed, but they keep it close to the vest. It's a freaking cult. So it's held so tight, and that's how they want it, that cracking it is just such an impossibility or so damn difficult, and they're so insulated in this one spot that it's not as easy as it would be in another community for the police to go in and crack something like this, or the FBI to come in. Not saying that they shouldn't have tried a hell of a lot more than they did, but is that how it's looked at? If it's just it's just everywhere, you go after one, you get it,
so.
Everybody, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't think so.
No,
I see why you would ask the question.
Yeah.
But this has historically been a community of very little crime of any kind. And if there were crimes, I mean, there were, of course, essays.
But that's reported. There's low crime that's reported, but because they don't look at it as a crime, basically.
No, they did. No, they did. They did. Okay. I mean, there's an FLDS woman in my house right now.
Okay.
Who her daughter had been... experienced that crime. And she went to the local police when, you know, when it was the FLDS.
Mm-hmm.
And that they took it very seriously. And her particular perpetrator, it was recommended that the perpetrator who was get a very, very light sentence. And the reason was because since the man who took the initial report was FLDS, they thought it wouldn't have credibility in court. So, you know, this mother had to just agree with a very light sentence just to have any kind of justice for her daughter. So they, you know, it's kind of a stereotype that they protect all this. And I just don't think we can say that that's true across the board. But this is now it's a whole different situation. Most of the town is not FLDS. They are either ex-FLDS or outsiders. And I would say only between 3% and 5% of the town are still FLDS. So I don't think it has anything to do with any kind of cult mentality.
Okay.
But I do think that they are understaffed. And I think it's complicated because it's a border town, you know, having to have certifications, this officer can only, you know, work, you know, and that
jurisdiction stuff. Yeah.
Right. And I do think that the police are trying to do a good job and act on the reports that they hear. I don't think, I just don't know how much, crimes are being reported, but I do know that there's more than there used to be because
who's going to report it if they're not going to do anything about that?
Well, and also they don't have the like you said, Christine, the definitions, they don't understand what's going on, you know, and kind of like, you know, we've covered IBLP as well, the Duggars, you know, and it's called, what was it? Moral crimes or something. It's not even SA.
It's some other wording. Like they change the language, you know, to make them feel better about their crap. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But I think that there does need to be more predator education among these beautiful, sweet people. Because even when they leave the FLDS, then you know what happens a lot? It's like they're on a pendulum. They were so constricted and followed so many rules. Now that they're free, mostly young people, then they try everything. You know, they experiment. And so now there's a drug problem that never used to exist and a theft problem that didn't used to exist and more SA that didn't used to exist. I mean, it probably used to exist. Well, clearly it did, but not the same kind that you find at parties when somebody, you know, is passed out or.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more that young people need to be educated on.
I like that predator education. No kidding. I mean, unfortunately our society needs a hell of a lot more of that.
It should be required in every place. I want to go over here. Some of the people you risked everything to get out went back to Bateman, even though he's locked away.
The same way Warren Jeff's followers never let go. I mean, after everything you did to help them see it, how does that land with you?
Do you mean the people who still believe in Sam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get it. I get it. I understand cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And your viewers know what that is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, their brains create a workaround. But I do think that this documentary series is making some of them think. I know a couple of them watched it. I think that it's really difficult because this is so frustrating too. Okay. So most of the people who still believe in Sam are in one location, one house. And I don't know why the land trust that decides who gets the houses allocated this house to one of the faithful followers of Sam. I mean, I do know why, but I don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. So now this one big house, it's basically their own kind of cult compound. So they're subjected to groupthink and pressure from each other and yeah. reinforcement and validation from each other. So they could have more easily been able to wake up to reality had they not all been in that one house. But, you know, if they were forced to go live somewhere else on their own so they could do their own thinking. So that's very, very frustrating to me to see.
Isolated from critical thinking.
Yeah.
You yourself escaped a relationship like that and thinking like that and coercive control like that. There comes a point where you see reality for reality's terms and you're able to see the errors in the ways of the way you were thinking. And I'm sure this has probably run through your mind, especially while you were with them, of how do I take what I've learned and help them see that? How do I help get them there? How do I help inspire them to see what reality truly is? How do you do that, I guess, is my question. How would you want them to see it? How can they get there to see the reality of what's going on around them? Certainly a documentary does help, but how do you think they can get there? And can, I guess, can all of them truly get there? Or are some people just, I mean, I guess not helpable because they don't want it. They won't see it. Maybe they're not capable of seeing it. I don't know. What's your thoughts?
Well, I did try to help them engage their critical thinking in small steps. Yeah. And one of these was I wanted them to read The Gift of Fear.
Mm-hmm. Gavin DeBecker, great book.
Yeah. So they put that scene, which I forgot about, in the documentary. In the gift of fear will help you know how to stay safe from predators. And I said that right in front of Sam. Yep. So that was risky. I guess that could have been a little leakage there.
Yeah.
But so because I thought, you know, the patterns in a predator are evident in this relationship that they have with Sam. So if I could get them to read it and think, oh, this is how I'm going to stay safe from outside predators, then maybe they would put two and two together. If I went straight in and said the truth, they would have just put up a wall and I wouldn't have access to them anymore and they wouldn't trust
sure.
me.
Sure.
So the other big tool that I had was my own story, because telling my own story was something that they wouldn't put their walls of defense up because it was my story, but they could see the similarities and connect the dots. So I did tell my story to Julia, and that was when the dam of truth burst open, because she understood that I understood and mm-hmm. wasn't going to judge her. I was trying to tell my story to the rest of the girls, but Sam was prohibiting it. So I would try all these different ways to get my story in there. Like I had a USB stick with some photos that they wanted. And I said, I'll give this to you after y'all come here and let me tell my story. But even that didn't work. She popped in as if that was going to happen and said, no, I just want to get the USB stick. We'll have to do the story later. And they kept finding ways to not listen because Sam made them afraid because he knew what my story was.
It's just like you wanted your own 12-step meeting. I mean, where you're sharing so everyone can identify. And that's when the floodgate opened. Christine, what would you tell Christine from who you are now to at the beginning of this entire thing? What advice would you give her?
I would say play the long game. You know, understand that this is going to be the most difficult thing you've ever done and be okay with that. I would tell her that this is going to be painful on so many levels, but it's worth it because there were times, I'm going to choke up. There were times when I didn't want to do it anymore. I mean, I kept thinking about the little girl that was next to me in the car when Sam was telling me what he, you know, I just kept thinking of her, who I'm very close to, by the way. And she wanted this story to come out. Very proud of her. So I just kept thinking about her, and that would drive me forward. And when the going got really tough emotionally, I would focus more on, I would tell that Christine to just keep focusing on that girl and the end result and quit worrying about how much I'm going to hurt those people. I was hurt. I knew they would be hurt, but I was hurting them in the same way that someone hurts their drunk friend when they take their keys away.
Yeah.
There are,
you get that?
Yeah.
100%.
1,000%. Obviously, he's behind bars, but he still has some control over that house and mm-hmm. those that are there. You've also said that, you know, there's others out there. I don't know if they're to the level of Sam or not, but you've been through this firsthand in a way no one else has been. That wasn't there because they were bamboozled into it. You were there with a purpose. You've seen it as close as anyone's going to get. You've flown so close to the sun. Mm-hmm. What needs to be done? What can be done? What should be done to prevent the next Sam Bateman? Because inevitably, they're going to rise up, or multiple will rise up.
I think our country, the world needs far more education on cult psychology, invisible influence, and coercive control. Because if we had coercive control laws in Arizona, maybe they could have pulled him away, arrested him just on the coercive control. He checks every box.
Yeah.
You know, and so what if that could have been his arrest and given the girls time to think and feel safe so that they could come forward sooner with the abuses that he was perpetrating upon them? And I think that's the most important thing. Every state needs to have, you know, these coercion laws.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you guys allow swearing on your?
Yeah, 1,000%.
Okay, so I mean, we need laws against mindfuckery.
Yes,
mindfuckery.
Yes.
Oh my God, I got a new word.
I agree.
I call people nutters. I call them everything, but mindfuckery. That's a good one.
We do.
Yeah.
We 1,000%. We do.
I used to use mind broken. Yeah, that's good mindfuckery.
I want to wrap on this. There obviously there's still some of the women, some of the girls that are, as we just talked about, in that house. If one of them sneaks away with a phone, jumps onto YouTube and sees this interview and watches you and knows the interactions that they've had with you in the past, maybe they've seen the stock, maybe they're curious. What would you say directly to them right now if they're watching this and you want to speak directly to them to help them move forward on a path of survival?
I would say you are a victim. The things that you were led to believe are not your fault. You have been exploited by somebody who knew damn well he wasn't a prophet, and that you have the opportunity to start your own life and find true love and make your own choices. I would also want them to know that I am sorry for the betrayal in the sense that it hurt them, but this I did to help them get to their own freedom. And I am still here for them. I still care about them. They were extraordinary women, my friends. I mean, Sam didn't pick losers. These women were smart, beautiful, kind, and they still are. And they have nothing to be ashamed of. Just think hard. Think of all the times that Sam made these prophecies that didn't come true or said these things that turned out to be false. Just count them up, write them down, and realize that you've been taken advantage of, and it's not your fault.
Christine Marie, absolutely fascinating conversation, absolutely amazing work. A huge thank you to her for joining us and sharing her story and message of hope for those girls who still are under the coercive control of Samuel Bateman to this day, even though he's behind bars for crimes against humanity. Your thoughts, your feelings, love to hear them in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. And we'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.